nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so we've started a discussion on sequential logic optimization. Let's continue with that topic today. From a quick recap from the previous lecture, the problem of finite state machine synthesis is stated as follows. Given an input, which is a specification in a finite state machine format, right, either a state transition graph or a state table, you need to synthesize an optimized implementation, which consists of gates and flip-flops. So you start off with a functional specification of the finite state machine, right, where you have state, state transitions. Now, we discussed in the previous lecture that the inputs, outputs, or states may be symbolically specified. In other words, you may use symbols rather than binary encoded values to specify them. In this example, the inputs and outputs are actually already encoded. However, the states are symbolic, right? The other thing that to note in the finite state machine specification is that you could have incompletely specified finite state machines, meaning that in certain states, when certain inputs are applied, either the next state or the output can be a don't care, right? So with such input specifications, eventually you would like to synthesize minimal implementations of sequential circuits, which consist of your state elements, flip-flops or latches, and the combination logic. So, that's okay. Yeah. Okay. So, there are three key steps in this process of going from a functional specification to a gate-level implementation. The first step is state minimization. So here, we optimize the finite state machine specification itself because the specification may have redundancies or opportunities to reduce the number of states. And we will discuss in detail today how that is done. The next step is the process of, the step of state encoding, where you take those symbolic labels, whether they were for the inputs, outputs, or states, and you actually encode them using, you take those symbolic labels for inputs, outputs, or states and encode them using binary patterns. And once you do that, you can actually take the next state functions and the output functions that you can derive from by analyzing the finite state machine, the encoded finite state machine specification, and you can specify Boolean functions, combinational functions that will need to be realized in order to generate the next state bits as well as the output logic. Okay. So once you have those functions, then it is the usual combinational logic synthesis that we have already discussed. Depending on whether you want a two-level or multi-level implementation, you use two-level minimization techniques or multi-level minimization techniques, right? So what we will focus on are these two key steps, right? We are still reusing all the combinational logic synthesis techniques we've talked about, but before you can invoke combinational logic synthesis, starting with the finite state machine specification, you need to first perform state minimization and then state encoding. And hopefully perform these in a manner such that after you go through combinational logic synthesis, the final implementation you get is minimal. Okay. So we'll start off with the problem of state minimization. You can perform state minimization because given a finite state machine specification, some of the states in it may actually be equivalent, right? And this could happen because the designer has specified the finite state machine in the most intuitive or convenient manner. However, it may not be the most optimal manner in terms of the size or number of states of the finite state machine, right? So in state minimization, basically the process is boils down to identifying these equivalent states and merging them into a single state. And you can do that in doing so, you're guaranteed not to affect the I/O input-output functionality of the finite state machine you started off with. So if you have a finite state machine and you identify equivalent states, by merging them, the new finite state machine will behave exactly the same as the previous one. Under any possible sequence of inputs, the outputs that the two produce will be exactly the same, right? This process of merging states often reduces the complexity of the implementation. That's the reason you do it. But note that it's not always guaranteed to do that, because state minimization is performed as the directly on the specification or on the FSM specification. There is very little correlation to actual gates at that stage. Okay. So this is, in many cases, reducing the number of states in the finite state machine specification certainly makes the FSM smaller for further steps of synthesis. So that's a good thing. But if you ask the question, does it always lead to a smaller gate level circuit at the end? Well, not necessarily. Okay. Now the sequential circuit, of course, at the end consists of gates and flip flops. And reducing the number of states in general, of course, is going to help you encode those states with fewer bits and therefore will require fewer flip-flops. So if you think of the complexity of the gate level, the sequential circuit in terms of number of flip-flops, finite state FSM minimization or merging equivalent states certainly will, you know, in some cases it may not reduce the number of bits, but it can never increase the number of bits. So, you know, you can only get a benefit. But if you look at the number of gates, the impact of FSM minimization on the number of gates is not as well understood. Okay. But empirically, people believe that this is a good, designers believe this is a good thing to do. Now, the definition of what states are equivalent actually differs when you have completely specified FSMs and incompletely specified FSMs. Okay. And we'll see how the problem differs, and consequently we will look at procedures for automatically performing state FSM minimization in both completely and incompletely specified FSM. So we'll start off with the easier case, the simpler case, which is a completely specified FSM. So in a completely specified FSM, as we know, from all current states under all possible inputs, the next state and output are fully defined. You do not have any don't cares. So in a completely specified FSM, two states are said to be equivalent if and only if the output sequences produced by the FSM when initialized in the two states are equal for any input sequence. What do we mean by that? If you think of a thought experiment where I gave you two black boxes, okay, you don't know what's inside the black box, but what I've done is I have two copies of the FSM, one inside each of these black boxes. One of them is initialized in state SI, one state. The other FSM is initialized in state SJ. And I've initialized the FSMs and I've given these boxes to you. All you can do is you can apply inputs of any length, any value, and you can observe the outputs. Given these two black boxes, if you can, purely by looking at the I/O behavior, if you can tell the difference between the two FSMs, in other words, if the two FSMs under the same input sequence can ever produce a different output, then those two initial states that I initialize the FSMs in, that is SI and SJ, are not equivalent. If you cannot tell the difference for all possible input sequences, the outputs produced are the same, then they are said to be equivalent. Those two states are equivalent. Well, that thought experiment is good, but it requires application of a potentially large and possibly unbounded number of input sequences. How many, you know, I haven't specified the length of the input sequence. It could be unbounded. So it's not a very practical procedure to actually exhaustively apply all possible input sequences and tell whether two states are equivalent. You need a more efficient procedure. Okay. That's good as a definition, but you need a more efficient procedure. And this theorem helps you in that direction. It gives you, suggests a more efficient procedure. It says that two states of a completely specified FSM are equivalent if and only if, for every input, note that when I say every input, this is just one input, not a sequence of inputs, just one input. Every input, the outputs are identical, outputs produced by the FSM in the two cases are identical, and the corresponding next states are equivalent. So this, applying this test only requires you to apply one input, a sequence of just one input. You don't need to look at longer sequences. However, it is a recursive definition. What do I mean by that? Imagine if this were an FSM and you are trying to check whether states SI and SJ are equivalent. Well, what this theorem tells you is SI and SJ are equivalent if and only if, when you apply the same inputs, the outputs are the same. So when you apply input 0 from SI, the output produced is O1. When you apply input 0 from SJ, the output produced is O3. So for SI to be equal to SJ, one of the conditions is O1 has to be equal to O3. It's not the only condition. Also, when you apply a one input from SI and one input at SJ, the output should be the same. Therefore, O2 should also be equal to O4. So, O1 equals O3 and O2 equals O4. And the next states that they go, that the FSM would go to, starting with SI and SJ, when you apply the same input, should also be equivalent. So, for SI and SJ to be equivalent, not only should O1 and O3 be the same, O2 and O4 be the same, but SK and SM should also be equivalent. And SL and SN should also be equivalent. The corresponding next states should also be equivalent. Okay. But this is like a chicken and egg problem. In fact, you started off with the problem of trying to find out if SI and SE are equivalent. And now you have two pairs, SK, SM, as well as SL, SN, that you now need to prove equivalent. Right? So how is this going to help? Well, it turns out that you can do this recursively. If you do this recursively, eventually, you will reach a fixed point, meaning that you will have either be able to conclude that the two states are equivalent or not. And you will, moreover, what is interesting is you will be able to do that in a bounded number of steps. Okay. Before we move on, let's to talking about a procedure, an algorithm to automatically detect equivalent states. Let's try to eyeball this example and see if, you know, do you think this contains equivalent states? S3 and S4 are equivalent. Why do you feel they are equivalent? Okay, if you apply a 0, the next state is the same. That's good. And the output is also same when you apply a 0. Similarly, you need to consider all inputs. So similarly, when you apply a 1, the output is 1 in both cases, and the next state is also the same. So S3 and S4 are equivalent. Absolutely right. Any others? S2 is also equivalent to S3 and S4. Right? For the same reasons. You may have to go through a slightly longer analysis, but you will realize that S2, S3, S4 are all equivalent. In fact, this FSM is derived from a smaller FSM shown here by just replicating state S2 twice. Okay. So we just created two more copies of S2 and just named them S3 and S4. And the first time you apply a 1 from S1, you go to S2, and then you go to the next copy, and then you go to the next copy. You can continue this process by creating more and more copies. And that entire family of FSMs will all be equivalent to this, because all those copies of the states you created are all equivalent, right? So in order to come up with a procedure to identify equivalent states, let's look at the complementary property of equivalence, the exact opposite. What does it mean for two states to be distinguishable? Two states, SI and SJ, of an FSM are distinguishable if and only if there exists a finite length input sequence, which when applied to M causes different output sequences depending on whether it was initialized in SI or SJ. So again, you have two copies of the finite state machine initialized in the two states that you're trying to compare. And if there exists a finite length input sequence that will produce different outputs from these two copies, then those two states are said to be distinguishable. And in fact, the input sequence that produces the differing outputs is called a distinguishing sequence for this pair of states. Okay. Distinguishing sequences, you know, apart from applications in identifying and minimizing FSMs, identifying equivalent states and minimizing FSMs, distinguishing sequence is also important, for example, from an automatic test pattern generation point of view. If you have a sequential circuit, we've already talked about manufacturing defects. Well, if you have a manufacturing defect in a sequential circuit, the finite state machine has potentially changed, right? And one way to detect the difference between the two finite state machines is if you apply an input, if that fault in, let's say, in the combinational logic is activated and propagates to the state bits, then you have in the fault-free and faulty cases, you have circuits in two different, the circuit will be in two different states. Then, if you apply a distinguishing sequence that will discern, can tell you the difference between whether the FSM is in that the fault-free state or the faulty state, then you have a test sequence for that particular defect, right? Of course, the distinguishing sequence itself should not be invalidated by the defect, but just wanted to give another example to say that this is an interesting concept that has multiple applications. In fact, if the distinguishing sequences of length k, if there exists a distinguishing sequence of length k, SI and SJ are said to be k distinguishable. Right? That is, you can apply in k cycles or k using k inputs in k steps, you can tell that they are different. So if you look at this example state table, comparing states A and B, are they distinguishable? And if so, what is the value of k? If they are k distinguishable, what is the value of k? If you look at A and B, just by applying input 1, you see that the output produced is different. 1 in the case of state A and 0 in the case of state B. So A and B are 1 distinguishable. By applying just one input, input of length 1, sequence of length 1, you can distinguish the outputs. How about A and E? Are they 1 distinguishable? No, because under the input 0, the output is 0 in both cases. Under input 1, the output is 1 in both cases. So in order to understand whether they are distinguishable, one way to think about it is to sort of draw a tree of possibilities of next states and outputs when you apply the different possible input values, right? So when you apply a 0 and a 1 in both cases, when you apply a 0 from A, you go to E. When you apply a 0 input, you get an output of 0 and go to E. Apply a 1 input, you get a 1 output and go to D. From state E, you go to C with a 0 and F with a 1. Right? So if you look at the same input of length 1, the outputs are identical. However, the next states are different, so you can continue this process and see if they are two distinguishable next, right? From E, if you apply a 0 or a 1, well, you'll get a 0 here, you get a 1 here, it's just the same as this, and you go to C and F respectively, right? I guess I need to write a little smaller here. From D, when you apply a 0, you go to F with output 0. And when you apply a 1 from D, you go to B with an output of 0. Similarly, in this case, let's look at what the next states and outputs are. From C, with 0, you go to E and 0. And with the 1, you go to B with 1. Right? I'm just exhaustively tracing out the trajectories of these two copies of the FSM if you started off with these two different states as the initial states. Right? So continuing from F, it's B0 and C0. Right? So far are we able to tell? Are these two distinguishable? If you apply 0 as the second input, you get 0 as the output in both cases. 0, 1 gives you 0, 1. 1, 0 gives you 1, 0 as an output. 1, 1 also gives you 1, 0 as an output. So thus far these are not two distinguishable. Now are they three distinguishable? Are there any corresponding pair of states from which further applying one input can actually give you different outputs? B and C. Here, right? If you look at B and C, you know that B and C, when you apply one input, are going to give different outputs. So if you look at these paths, remember you need to apply, you can't take, you know, different cases for the two FSMs. You need to apply the same input sequence to both, right? So if you apply 1-1, the FSMs initialized from A and E will move to B and C respectively, and then subsequently, if you apply another input of a 1, you get, from B you get the output of 0, and from C you get an output of 1. Okay? So you have been able to distinguish between these two states with a sequence of length 3. So these states are 3 distinguishable, right? Because you have a sequence of input sequence of length 3, and when you apply it, you actually get different outputs. So how do we turn this into a systematic process, an automatic procedure to identify equivalent states? Remember, equivalent states are just states which are not distinguishable, right? States which are not distinguishable for any k are equivalent states. So it's just whether you apply identify equivalent states or identify distinguishable states and then say states which are not distinguishable but equivalent is the same thing. So the procedure we'll devise to identify equivalent states is going to be partitioning the set of states. So you have a set of states in your original finite state machine. Any pair of them can potentially be equivalent. So what we'll be doing is by analyzing information from the FSM specification, either the state transition graph or the state table, we will be recursively partitioning the set of states in the FSM into smaller groups or smaller partitions such that eventually, once we finish this procedure, when the procedure terminates, the states remaining in each partition are all one equivalent set of states. Okay? So we want to, given the set of the entire state space of the FSM, you want to identify these partitions of that state space which are represent equivalent states. And we will be doing this iteratively. So first we start off with all states in one group. So initially your hypothesis is all states are equivalent. Then what do? You apply the same look at states for which applying a single input will give you different outputs. In other words, these are one distinguishable states. So look at one distinguishable states based on application of a single input. Look at which states give unique outputs and divide your original set of states into smaller groups on that basis. Then, well, you can't stop here because this is only, you've only split one distinguishable states. You need to also look at 2 distinguishable, 3 distinguishable and so on. So the next step is you split states whose next states when applying the same input are in different groups. Because you know that if you, given 2 states, if 2 states are in the same group and you apply the same input, they go to different groups, then you know that from that point onwards, you can apply some input and get a different output. Because, you know, so 2 states which on applying the same input will lead to 1 distinguishable states are 2 distinguishable, right? So that's what you do here. And you keep repeating step 3, you keep repeating step 3 until there is no further change in this grouping or partitioning of the states that you have. And once you terminate, you are guaranteed that this procedure will correctly identify equivalent states. States that remain in the same partition are all equivalent. The procedure, what is interesting is this process is guaranteed to terminate in ns steps where ns is the number of states in the finite state machine. As shown here, it has quadratic complexity, but there exists a more efficient n log n algorithm to do the same thing. Okay. Let's look at an example. So I've just enumerated the 4 steps of the procedure here again, copied from the previous slide. We'll try to apply it to an example. So this is the example finite state machine we'll look at first. 4 states. For convenience, I've just shown the output part of the state transition table. So, you know, these are equivalent. If you look for each state, from present state S1 through S4, under input 0 and 1, I've just shown what the outputs are. So just for convenience. So the first step is to start off with all states in one group. So I have one group of states S1 through S4. Second step is to split this group into groups such that applying the same input, if it leads to different outputs, then those 2 states should be in different groups. So if you look at the output part of the state table shown here, you see that S1 produces 0 and 1. S2 and S3 both produce 1 and 1. And S4 produces 1 and 0 under application of input 0 and 1 respectively. So accordingly, you can partition this group of 4 states into S1, S2, S3 together, and S4. So you have 3 groups. So that is step 2. Now you need to go to step 3, which is split states whose next states when applying the same input are in different groups. In other words, look at states in the same group here, S2 and S3. If applying the same input from S2 and S3 can lead you to next states which are in different groups, then you know that S2, S3 are 2 distinguishable, right? So you look for that. So if you apply a 0 from S2, you go to S2 as the next state. If you apply a 1 from S2, you go to S3, right? So if you apply a 0 from S2, you go to S2, and apply a 0 from S3, you go to S3, but both of them are already in the same group. Similarly, if you apply a 1 from S2, you go to S3, and 1 from S3 takes you back to S2, again, in the same group, right? So you are not able to apply any input which would cause the next states for these two states to be in different groups. Therefore, there is no change in step 3, and at this point, the procedure terminates, right? Further iterations are not going to help you. Okay. Any questions? Let's work through another example to see if we can reinforce it. Slightly larger. So here we have six states. Again, I've just shown the state transition graph and the state table representation side by side. Start off with all states in one group. Split states that are one distinguishable, that is, when you apply the same input, you get different outputs. Looking at the state table, you can see that A, C, and E give you 0 and 1 when you apply x equals 0 and x equals 1 respectively. So all of them are going to give you the same output. So A, C, and E will be in one group, and B, D, and F actually give you output of 0 and 0 when you apply input of 0 and 1. So purely based on applying a single input, all you can say is that I can partition this set of six states into two partitions, one of them containing ACE, other containing BDF. Now, that doesn't mean that ACE are equivalent or BDF are equivalent. The procedure has not terminated yet. It only means that any state from here is one distinguishable from any state from there, right? By applying the same input, you will get different outputs. So now you move on to step 3, where you look for states whose next states, when applying the same input, end up in different partitions here. Okay. So if you do that, you can see that if you look at ACE, A's next state, when applying x equals 0, let's consider x equals 0 first, A's next state is E, C's next state is E, and E's next state is C. So C and E are already in the same group here, so that's not of any help. Similarly, when you apply x equals 1, the next states for A, C, and E are D, B, and F respectively. And D, B, and F are also in the same group. So A, C, E cannot be split any further in this step. Okay. However, if you look at BDF, if you look at x equals 0, the next states are F, and B respectively. Well, those are in the same group. When you look at x equals 1, the next states are D, B, and C. Now, when you look at D, B, and C, well, C is in a different group from B and D. Therefore, F, which led to the next state of C, can be split from B and D. Because when applying the input 1 to these three states, B and D will lead to one set of states, and F will lead to the state C, which is one distinguishable from the states that you reach starting with B and D. Therefore, F has to be split off in this step. And you continue to do the same thing. So now, if you look at it, you'll see that from ACE, these now become distinguishable, because if you look at the next states, from ACE, let's start off with 0, you have E, E and B. Oh, I'm sorry, E, E and C. Okay. So, X equals 0 leads to E, E and C. Well, those are in the same group, so that doesn't help you any. X equals 1 will lead to D, B, and F. Well, you know F now is in a different group from D and B. Therefore, you can split off E, which leads to F as the next state. Okay. So A, C, and E, this group is further split into just the states A and C in one partition and E in a separate partition. Now, if you repeat the process, step 3, you'll see that all next states of pairs of states here, A and C and B and D, will end up in the same partition. Therefore, you cannot further partition these groups anymore, and there is no change. So this is your final set of equivalent states. So A and C are equivalent, B and D are equivalent, E and F are not equivalent to anything else. Yes?
So the next state has to be from the same group.
Correct.
So for example, for ACE, when the input is 1, the outputs are DBF, which is not in AC, but since they're in one single chunk, that's why we don't split it.
At this stage.
Right.
At this stage, however, when your BDF are not in one chunk anymore, which is why you split it.
So at this point, they're, because we moved three steps now, each of them are three distinct?
That's correct. So effectively, what this procedure is doing is it's first deriving the set of one distinguishable states, the two distinguishable, three distinguishable, and so on. So states that are in different partitions are distinguishable. Okay. So this process is relatively efficient, at least in terms of the number of states in the finite state machine. And, you know, you can apply it to identify equivalent states. Once you have equivalent states, what do? You, given the equivalent group of states, groups of states, you can merge all states in an equivalence class or group of equivalent states into a single state. Right, to reduce the number of states in the finite state machine. And you need to do some bookkeeping for the transitions. All transitions going in or out of these states, any of the states in that group will end up going into or out of the merged state. So, for example, this is the first example we looked at, and we found out that S2 and S3 are equivalent. So when you merge S2 and S3, what is the reduced finite state machine going to look like? First of all the states which are not equivalent can just be copied down. They will still remain. And transitions between those states will still remain. S2 and S3 will get collapsed into a single state. So you collapse S2 and S3 into a single state. And if you look at the zero transition from S2, it goes to S2. And zero transition from S3, it goes to S3. Well, now S2 and S3 are the same. I've called it S2. Maybe S2 prime would have been more appropriate. So let's just assume there's a prime here. This is S2 prime. S2 and S3 have been merged into S2 prime. So whether a transition goes into S2 or S3, in both cases it will go into S2 prime. So the zero from S2 goes in, S2 prime goes into itself. And similarly, if you look at the one transition from S2, it goes into S3, and the one from S3 goes into S2. So you have the self loop also for the one case. And finally, when you have input zero from S1, you go into S3. So that now goes into the merged state S2 prime, okay, the 0, 0. And this is your reduced finite state machine. So you collapse these two states, and all the transitions that go out of these states will now get merged. Similarly, all transitions coming into these states get merged and go into this single merged state. Okay. By doing that, now you have a reduced finite state machine, and then you can proceed with the subsequent synthesis steps using this reduced FSM. Okay, that summarizes the procedure for completely specified finite state machines. Okay. You can also do this for incompletely specified FSMs. However, it gets a little more tricky. The notion of equivalent states is not as straightforward anymore. It gets a little more tricky. And the procedure, from a computational complexity point of view, the procedure of identifying and merging these states, or to be more precise, identifying these states, gets much, much more complex. Computationally complex. So let's study the process for incompletely specified finite state machines now. First of all, we define the definition, the analogous concept of equivalence in the case of incompletely specified FSMs is called compatibility. Two states are said to be compatible if and only if they agree on the outputs when the outputs are all specified and the corresponding next states when all the next states are specified, are compatible. Well, why is this or how is this? If you look at this definition and what we said for equivalence, how does it differ? The main difference here is that either the output or the next state may be unspecified, right? So what we are saying here is if it's a don't care, well, that's okay, right? If it's a don't care, you can always specify that don't care to the right value, to the same value, as the other case. So you have two different states that you're comparing on the same input. Suppose in one case the output is a zero, other case the output is a don't care. You can specify the don't care to zero so that you produce the same output. Right? Similarly, if the next state in one case is SI or S1 and the next state in the other case is don't care, you can specify that don't care next state also to be S1 in order to make these equivalent. So in a sense, compatibility is just similar to the definition of equivalence, except that when you have a don't care, you assume that implicitly that you'll be specifying the don't care appropriately so as to cause these two, the behavior of the FSM, the input-output behavior starting from the two states to be the same. Okay. So let's give you a couple of examples to just reinforce its definition. Here's an example of an incompletely specified FSM. Here, the only incompleteness is in the output specification. So if you see under, in this case, under input 1, the output is a don't care. Similarly, from B, under input 0, the output is a don't care. Now, is A compatible with B? Compatibility is, just to distinguish from equivalence, is denoted with the tilde sign here. Is A compatible with B? And the answer is yes, because if you look at input 0 from A, the next state is going to be C. Input 0 from B, the next state is also C. So next states are in fact the same. The outputs are 1 and don't care. So you can always take this don't care here from B and make it a 1. So the 0 slash dash from B can be turned into a 1. And then the outputs and next states would be identical for input 0. If you look at input 1, on the other hand, on input 1, from state A, you go to state E with the output of dash, don't care. And from state B, you go to state E with an output of 1. So again, you can turn this don't care into a 1 and therefore cause, by specifying the don't care here to a 1 and the don't care here to a 1 as well, both the don't cares to a 1, you can cause the behavior of the finite state machine when it starts off in state A and state B to be identical. Therefore, you conclude that A is indeed compatible with state B. Similarly, if you ask the question, is B, given this incompletely specified FSM, is B compatible with C? Okay. Again, the answer should be yes, because if you look at the applying the input 0, from B, you go to C, and from C, you go to B. The outputs are 0 and dash, so the implicit assumption here is that this don't care is specified to a 0. The 0 slash dash from B, this don't care is specified as 0, 0. And if you look at the 1 input from B and C, if you on the applying 1, you go to A from C and you go to E from B. The output is the same, but the next states are different. So now the recursive definition of compatibility kicks in, which means that B is compatible with C only if and only if A is also compatible with E. And in the process, you're implicitly also assuming that the 0 slash dash, don't care, is actually made to 0 slash 0. Right? So, put differently, two states are compatible in an incompletely specified FSM if you can specify the don't cares in the FSM to make those, and turn it into a completely specified FSM where those two states now become equivalent. Right? So, that is the definition of compatibility. But there is a very important difference from equivalence, right? So what is the difference between equivalence in fully specified FSMs and compatibility in incompletely specified FSMs? Equivalence is transitive. What that means is, if I give you three states A, B, and C, and I tell you that A is equivalent to B and B is equivalent to C, then you can conclude automatically that A is also equivalent to C. In compatibility, that is not true. A is compatible with B and B is compatible with C does not imply that A is compatible with C. Can anybody explain why not? Why does transitivity not hold for state compatibility?
When you're checking the equivalence between A and B, you can specify don't cares in a particular manner. And when you're checking it between B and C, you can specify it in another manner. So
precisely. In fact, the example right here tells you why not. For A to be compatible with B, the implicit assumption is that the 0 slash dash, this don't care from B, is made 0, 1. On the other hand, for B to be compatible with C, you have to specify that to 0, 0. You can never do both at the same time. Right? So, that is the reason why A and, compatibility is not transitive, because the implicit requirements on how the don't care should be specified in order to cause identical I/O behavior can conflict between these two cases. So this is an important difference. And it has a very important implication on the complexity of identifying compatible states, okay, that, as we will discuss. But I just wanted to point out that, it's an important difference. Transitivity holds with state equivalence, but not with state compatibility. So the process of minimizing incompletely specified FSMs, unfortunately, is significantly more complex than, or the procedure is much more complex than the procedure for fully specified FSMs. One question you may ask is, why can't I transform this problem into a problem that I already know how to solve? Meaning, given an incompletely specified FSM, why don't I just randomly specify the don't cares in some way? And then I have a completely specified FSM. So then, why don't I minimize that completely specified FSM, just identify equivalent states, and then just live with whatever I get there? Well, two answers. First is there's huge number of possible ways to specify those don't cares, you know, all combinations. You may ask, does it really matter? Well, it turns out that setting the don't care values differently can lead to drastically different minimized FSMs eventually. For example, the same example we started off with. Let's say in one case you specify all both the don't cares to 1. You will end up, and then you have a completely specified FSM, and you minimize that using the procedure we've already discussed. You will end up with an FSM with 4 states. If you specify all the dash, both the dashes to 0 and you minimize, you'll end up with an FSM which has only 2 states. Right? So, in general, there is a vast difference between specifying the don't cares one way versus the other, and it's very difficult to tell a priori what is a good specification of don't cares. In other words, what will lead to a more minimized FSM after you perform the FSM minimization on the fully specified, resulting fully specified FSM. So, ideally, you need, so rather than enumerate all these possibilities of don't care specifications, you would like to come up with a procedure that does a reasonably efficient job of minimizing the incompletely specified FSM directly without enumerating the possibilities of the don't care assignments. Okay. And that's what we're going to discuss. Okay. So inherently, it's a more complex problem. Starting with an incomplete FSM specification, either state transition graph or state table, the first step, somewhat similar to the completely specified case, is to find the compatible pairs. Okay, just look at pairs of states initially and analyze whether they are compatible or not. And you can have 3 answers to this question. Given a pair of states, either you can conclude that they are, immediately conclude that they are compatible. For example, looking at A and B, if you look at A and B, the next states are C, and when x equals 0 in both cases, and next states are again identical when you apply x equals 1. The output, of course, requires the don't cares, you know, is don't care in some cases, so you need to specify those appropriately. However, the next states are identical. So, you know, if you remember the recursive definition of compatibility and equivalence, 2 states are compatible if and only if the outputs are the same for the same input when both the outputs are specified and the next states are also compatible. Here, you don't need to check whether C is compatible with C. It's the same state. Similarly, you don't need to check whether E is compatible with D. So you do not have the so-called implied pairs or the pairs that also need to be compatible for this pair of states to be compatible do not exist in this case. So this pair of states A and B are said to be unconditionally compatible. So there is no other conditions in terms of other states that need to be compatible for these 2 states to be compatible with each other. Similarly, you can have states where you can outright say that these are incompatible. So you have states where you can outright say they are compatible. If you look at A and C, they are incompatible because the outputs are different. Immediately you can see that, you know, these are on input x equals 0, you get a 1 here and you get a 0 there. So there's no way they can be compatible, right? So these are incompatible pairs. These are unconditionally compatible pairs. And then in between you have these conditionally compatible pairs where for these pairs of states to be compatible, some other pair also needs to be compatible. So if you look at A and E, for example, the outputs are 1 and 1 when x equals 0 and don't care in 0. So that from the output point of view, there's no problem. If you look at the next states, when you apply x equals 0, are C and D. So that's an implied pair. For A and E to be compatible, C and D also need to be compatible. When you apply x equals 1, the next states are A and E itself again. And that's a circular dependency which you don't need to check, you know. You are starting to prove whether A and E are compatible, and you say that A and E are compatible if A and E are compatible. I mean, that's a trivial case. You don't need to list A and E again here. Okay. Similarly, if you look at B and C, you'll say that B and C are compatible if C and D are compatible. If B and C are compatible, if B and C are compatible in one case, and A and E are compatible. So B and C is the trivial case, so you list AE as the implied pair. So for every pair of states to be compatible, either you can determine them to be unconditionally compatible, incompatible, or conditionally compatible, in which case you have one or more implied pair. So this is the first step. Tabulate all compatibility relationships between pairs of states, or find compatible pairs of states. Then the next thing you need to do is, remember, eventually in your FSM, you may have groups of states larger than two, which are compatible. Here you're only looking at states in pairwise manner. You need to have these larger groups of states that are compatible. So the next step is to find the so-called larger compatible sets. And in this case, it turns out that if you look at the set BCD, it turns out that BCD is compatible because BC, CD and BD are all compatible. Okay? So this is where the difference between fully specified and incompletely specified FSMs kicks in. In order to check if this were equivalence, in order to check if BCD were an equivalence class, you only needed to show that BC are equivalent and CD are equivalent. The BD case is implied. Whereas here, you need all three C2 pairs to be listed as compatible here. Okay. So, BCD are compatible, and in order to look at the implied classes for BCD to be compatible, you look at all pairs, that is BC, CD, and BD, and you look at the union of all these implied classes. Now, some of these can be removed because it is a circular dependency. So, you know, you're starting off trying to show that BCD are compatible. Then, of course, BD are compatible. You don't need to prove that again. Similarly, you're starting off showing that BCD, trying to show that BCD are compatible. So you don't need to explicitly again show that CD are compatible. So the only thing that remains is AE. So again, take the union of the implied pairs for all subsets, two subsets of this compatible, larger compatible set, and remove the trivial cases and list whatever remains here as the implied clauses. So you can do this to try to compose larger sets, and we'll see a more systematic way of doing that. But for now, just say that, imagine that somehow you need to take these compatible pairs and turn them into these larger groups of compatibles. Once you're done with finding larger compatible sets, it turns out that one option would be to just take each of these groups and call it a compatible state. However, that would be unnecessary. That is excessive. You only need to choose a minimum subset of this set of compatibles as states in your final minimized FSM, such that two conditions are satisfied. The first condition should be that this is a closed set. In other words, all the implied classes here, implied compatibility classes, are contained in it. What does that mean? What that means is, for example, for AE to be compatible, you need C and D to be compatible, but you have CD already compatible, a part of the same, another compatible within the same set. Okay. Similarly, for BCD to be compatible, you need AE to be compatible. So, but AE is included in the set. Right? So as a group, all the dependencies are included within the set. Okay. Even though individually they are not, as a group, all of these implications or requirements have been satisfied. Right? By definition. So that is what is a closed set. In addition, it also needs to be a complete set, meaning that all the states in your original FSM should appear at least at one place in this left-hand side. Okay. So once you do that, it tells you that you have covered the behavior of your entire FSM. You covered all the states. In addition, you covered all the required implications. Right? So if you pick a subset of these compatibles that is both closed and complete, then that gives you the minimum subset of states that you need to retain in your final finite state machine. So a final finite state machine will consist of two states. Let's say AE is one group of states, let's call it alpha. BCD is another group of states, let's call it beta. And then you can draw out your final finite state machine as just in terms of two states. Any questions at the higher level? We'll be going to more details of this, but as an overview, any questions about the procedure? All right, let's look at it in a little more detail. So here's an algorithm to minimize incompletely specified FSMs. First is you find pairs of compatible states, the first step shown the previous slide. Second is find the maximal compatibles. And third is to find the remaining prime compatibles. So it turns out that growing these pairs of compatible states into these larger groups has to be performed in two steps. The first is the step of maximal compatibles, and the second is prime compatibles. And finally, the fourth step is to select the minimum number of prime compatibles such that they form a closed and complete cover. This turns out to be yet another covering problem, okay? Yet another instance of where we are meeting our familiar covering problem. Right? And finally, you construct the reduced finite state machine. So we'll examine each of those steps in sequence. What are maximum? The first step we already know, how do you find pairs of compatible states? We've discussed it in the example. The second step is to find maximal compatibles. Now, maximal compatibles are sets of compatible states that are not strictly contained in any other set of compatible states. So these are sets that are as large as possible. You grow them any more and they're not compatible with each other. Okay. So these are groups of states that are as large in terms of cardinality as large as possible. And that is step two of the algorithm. The way you do this is, interestingly, again, borrowing from some techniques that we have already learned in previous modules, you associate a Boolean variable to each state, Si. One means that Si belongs to a maximal compatible. Zero means it does not. Take incompatible pairs that you identified in the first step and encode the constraints that these incompatible states can never appear in a compatible set. Okay? So you essentially create a clause with Si prime and Sj prime for each incompatible pair Si Sj. And, you know, that gives you a CNF formula in product of sums form. Multiply it out to get a sum of products expression, and that actually, each of the product terms in that sum of products expression is going to be a maximal compatible. Let's illustrate it with an example, and then we'll go back and see if we need to clarify the procedure further. So this is the state transition table for all possible states from A to H under inputs X1 through X7. Here are the next states and the outputs. So note here that the inputs have also been now symbolic. So this process of state minimization can be done before, as we saw, it happens before encoding. So you can do this both on a FSM where the inputs, outputs, and states are in binary, or they are symbols. So in this case, the states are symbols, the inputs are symbols, but the output is just 0 or 1. Okay. So you have don't cares at several places in this state transition table. Now, if you look at compatible pairs, you can show them using this kind of a matrix. Given all the states A through G on the one hand and B through H, are they compatible? Since A compatible with B is the same as B compatible with A, this is only, you know, this has to be either a lower diagonal or, lower triangular or upper triangular matrix. The diagonal entries, of course, all are by trivially a state is compatible with itself unconditionally. So you only need to look at, you know, these cases. If you look at A and B, for example, if you look at states A and B and walk through what happens on E for each of the input cases, you will see that A and B will have to be compatible if A and B are compatible. You don't need to talk about that. Don't care, so you don't need to do much. If A and D are compatible, so A and D becomes an implied pair here for A and B to be compatible. Don't care, so nothing to be done. A and B, trivial case. A and A are identical. Don't care. Right? So the only implied pair, if you look at rows A and B of this table, for A and B to be compatible, is going to be A and D. And you enter the implied pair here. So essentially what I've done is, for every pair of states, identified whether it is conditionally compatible, and if so, add the implied pairs in that cell. If it's incompatible, just mark it down with an X. Or if it's unconditionally compatible, just put the tilde down there. Okay. So this is just, this information just captures which pairs of states are compatible, incompatible, and conditionally compatible. Once you do this, what you do next is you compose this product of sums expression starting with incompatible states. So you don't use all the information from this table. You only use information from the X's. So if you have an X in this entry between A and C, you have a clause that says A prime or C prime, which means that A and C can never be in the same compatible set with each other, because you know that they are unconditionally incompatible, right? If you look at A and C, the outputs when you apply input X3 are 0 and 1. So A and C can never appear in the same compatible set. So A prime or C prime. Similarly, A and F can never appear A prime or F prime. So each of these X entries or incompatible pairs of states will lead to a single clause here. Now, what you do next is just multiply this out. So start with this product of sum expression. I've just copied it from the previous slide. So, you know, do the usual simplification, multiply it out into a sum of products expression. And this actually gives you the maximal compatibles. What this tells you is that all the states except C, F, G, and H can be in one, are all compatible with each other. So maximal compatibles here are each of these terms, look at the literals that are not present. Since you only have complemented literals here, after you multiply it out, you'll also remain with only complemented literals in the product terms. For each product term, look at the literals that are absent in that product term, and those indicate the states that belong to that compatible. So each product term corresponds to one compatible. So from this product term, you can derive the compatible ABDE, because those are the literals that are missing here. Similarly, from this product term, you derive the compatible BCD, and so on and so forth. So this is one maximal compatible set of states, another maximal compatible, another, and so on. Okay. But this is not sufficient. Just looking at the maximal compatibles alone is not sufficient, because if you want an optimal procedure, in other words, a procedure that will give you a minimal reduced finite state machine, after starting with the original incompletely specified FSM, you would like to come up with an FSM that has as few states as possible. In order to do that, it's not sufficient to just do this. Intuitively, you can also relate to that, because we took the information about compatible pairs of states, but we didn't use all of it. We only used the X's in order to generate this expression. So in a sense, there is still some information left over. So what you need to do is find additional prime compatibles. Okay. How do you do that? Well, first we'll define what a prime compatible is. Of course, maximal compatibles themselves are prime compatibles, but you have additional prime compatibles. Let C1 be a compatible set, and gamma 1 be the corresponding set of implied classes. Now you need to look at conditionally compatible sets, right? So for a set to be compatible, you have some implied classes. C1 is prime if and only if there doesn't exist another compatible set C2, such that C2 is a superset of C1, and the implied classes of C2 are a subset of the implied classes of C1. If I have a larger set of states with fewer implied classes, then C1 is not a prime compatible. Okay? So let's give an example here. So this is the same information from the previous slide, the step 1, which gives you the set of all compatible pairs. From here, we already have computed the maximum compatibles, that is using the procedure on the previous slide, starting off with the X entries, starting and encoding them as a product of some CNF formula, multiplying it out, sum of products, getting the maximum compatibles. Next, we can look at the implied classes for those maximal compatibles. If you look at ABDE, the implied class is actually nothing, okay? Because for ABDE, all subsets AB, AD, BD, BE, and so on, all 4 C2 subsets are unconditionally compatible, it turns out here. So, or the implied classes are contained within the set itself. So ABD has no implied classes. If you look at BCD, we need to look at pairwise. For B and C, they are fully compatible. There is no implied class. For B and D, the implied class is AB and DE. So you need to list out AB and DE here. Similarly, for C and D, you have DE and AG. Well, DE is already there. No need to repeat it, but you need to add AG. So what we do is take all pairs of these maximal compatibles that we have just found and list out their implied classes. Okay. Now what we may be able to do is find subsets of these maximal compatibles or smaller compatibles. If you ignore the implied classes, you would never care about them because you have a larger set here. However, you may have smaller sets whose implied classes are also smaller than this. And so those also should be considered in order to ensure that you consider all possibilities. For example, in this case, the other prime compatibles, if you look at BC, you have BCD here, and BC is a subset of BCD. However, its implied classes are zero. Nothing. Whereas if you want to grow to BCD, you have a larger set of implied classes. So, in this case, you need to keep BC. Okay? It is still a prime compatible. Even though BCD is a superset of it, the implied classes of BCD are also larger. Similarly, in this case, if you look at CD, again, CD also is a prime compatible because although it is a subset of BCD, its implied classes are also a subset of the implied classes of BCD, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you have, these are the other prime compatibles that you have. Now, what you need to do is put these together, the maximal prime compatibles and the other prime compatibles, put them together, and together analyze these and come up with a minimum subset. So, remember the two conditions, the subset of states should form a closed cover and it should be a complete cover. Meaning that, in this case, the minimum cover consists of ABDE, I'm just calling that state capital A, DEH, which is this one right here, which is state capital B, C, which is B, C, right here, and D, which is F, G, right here. Okay, so we've taken two states from the maximal compatibles and two states from the other prime compatibles, and that gives you the minimum cover. And you can verify that this minimum cover, first of all, the easy thing to verify is it complete? Does it include all the states of your original FSM? Well, it has A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H, so it has everything. It's a complete cover. Is it a closed cover? What does it mean to be a closed cover? All the implied classes should be contained within equivalence or compatible classes right here. So if you look at ABDE, well, there are no implied classes, so there is nothing to check there. If you look at DEH, you have AB and AD to check. AB are in the same group here. AD are also in the same group. So these implications are satisfied. If you look at BC, there is nothing implied, so nothing to check. If you look at FG, EH has got to be in the same implied, is in the implied class, and EH is in the same class here. Okay, so it is a closed set. All the implied classes, if you look at pairs of states in the implied classes, they fall in the same group here, in the original set you started off with. So it's both closed and complete, and therefore this satisfies, and if you go through the possibility of enumerating everything here, you'll actually see that you cannot come up with fewer states that satisfy both the conditions of being a complete cover and a closed cover. Okay. So this is another sort of covering problem here. Okay. So once you have this set, you construct the reduced FSM. This is same as the completely specified case, except as you are merging these states, the equivalent, the compatible states that you identified, you may need to specify don't cares appropriately. And of course, the procedure by design, by construction, ensures that you will be able to specify it. You will never have any conflicts in the way you specify don't cares across these different groups of states. So, starting with the state table here and the final set of compatible states that you identified, the minimum cover, now what you need to do is construct a table where each of these groups corresponds to just a single state, and you take all the rows in the original state transition table corresponding to these states in the same group and merge them to come up the entries of each of these rows, right? So let's see if we can do that for a couple of rows, and I'll leave the rest to you as an exercise. Seven inputs, four states in the reduced finite state machine. So for each state, let's look at A, which consists of rows A, B, D, E, or states A, B, D, E in your original FSM. So look at those rows, A, B, D, and E, and you should be able to combine those rows. So look at the next states for each of the entries in the same column for these rows, and those next states are guaranteed to fall in the same group. So you should be able to replace all of those with one of these capital A, B, C, capital B, capital C, or capital D. Okay. So if you look at X1, the output for next state is small a in X1, small b, don't care, and small b. But you know small a and small b are nothing but capital A. So the next state here is going to be capital A. And the output is 0, 0, don't care, and don't care, so the output is now zero. And you're guaranteed, because of the way you're identifying these compatible states, that you'll never have a conflict. You'll never have an output of zero or one, or zero in one case, one of these states, and one in another state. So you'll never end up with a conflict here. you are guaranteed that all these are compatible. Similarly, the next states are all guaranteed to be in the same group. Okay. So let's continue. Let's look at under input X2. For here you have a don't care. D, E, and E, right? A, B, D, E. So it's just D and E. Now when you have D and E, this is actually a very interesting situation. When you have D and E, you can either choose A or B as the next state. And it turns out it doesn't matter. No matter what you choose, you have a choice. Your answer is still, the FSM is still going to be correct. Okay. So we can just choose A here without loss of arbitrarily picking A. And then the output is 1. Under input X3, you have next state to be DA, don't care, and A. So look at where A and D are in the same group. That's only in capital A. And the output is 0. Under X4, you have the next state to be E, don't care, B, and don't care. So look at where E and B are in the same next state, are in the same group. So E and B are in the same next group here as capital A. And the output is a 1. Similarly for X5, output is a 0. The next states are small b, small a, small b and small b respectively. So where are A and B in the same group? Well, the first one, capital A. Okay. And the next one would be X6, AA, and E, right? So capital A, and 1. And the last one would also be A and 1. Okay? Yes?
Will there be an instance when all of them we don't care?
Well, it could be. If you have enough, a large number of don't care entries originally in your original FSM, it may be the case that all of them end up being don't cares. That's possible. In which case, you can pick arbitrarily. It doesn't matter.
We have to pick, or we just place a don't care?
You can still place a don't care, but eventually, when you go to the next step, when you're doing FSM encoding, you need a completely specified FSM. So you can just arbitrarily specify. That don't care is not going to be useful additionally. At least, it's not going to be useful to further minimize the number of states. So as far as FSM minimization is concerned, you used the flexibility and you still have don't cares left. So, similarly, you can go through the remaining rows. Essentially, you look at all the entries for each input for these rows and merge them together, and you are guaranteed that you will not have any conflicts because that's how you came up with the set of compatible states. Okay? Any questions? Well, it turns out that functionally, the behavior of the FSM when starting with D and E is basically going to be the same, whether you go with the state or the state, right? Yeah.
For BC and input X4, which is capital C entry,
okay.
What would the entering the role of that, it will be just a don't care with no next state specified?
Ah, okay. Yeah, you can leave it as a don't care if you want. So, okay, let's look at that example. So, capital C is B and C. If you look at under input X4, both are don't cares. So, this was basically the example the question you had asked previously. So, this, you can leave this as a don't care. Sure, you can leave it as a don't care and let the next step try to take advantage of the don't care. Or you can specify it at this point. From a number of states point of view, you cannot minimize the FSM further by exploiting this don't care. Okay. So you can specify it arbitrarily. Right. Any other questions? Okay, if not, this would be a good point to stop. So we will wrap things up here and move on to state encoding in the next lecture. Thank you.